Good morning, this is AM. I'm Tony Yeastley. With increasing and deadly efficiency, American forces are using drones to prosecute the war in Afghanistan and against Al-Qaeda and its operatives who use bases in Pakistan. In the latest remote-controlled attack, a drone has killed Al-Qaeda's deputy leader, Abu Yahya Alibi. The strike is reported to have been made in northwestern Pakistan. With more, here's North America correspondent Jane Cowan.
It's being called the biggest blow to Al-Qaeda since the killing of Osama bin Laden. The Libyan-born Abu Yahya al-Libi was killed in northwest Pakistan's Waziristan tribal region. The US doesn't officially talk about its CIA-run drone campaign, and the State Department's Mark Toner was making no comment on media reports of al-Libi's death.
I was just wondering whether or not you can comment at all.
I can.
Okay.
No comment, thanks. Sorry.
At the Pentagon, journalists got creative in trying to pry a confirmation from the Obama administration.
So not responding specifically to this operation yesterday or anything that happened, any incidents yesterday, do you have any indication that Abu Yahya al-Libi is less alive today than he was?
I have nothing for you on that today.
But the White House Press Secretary Jay Carney was willing to say this.
I can tell you that our intelligence community has intelligence that leads them to believe that Al-Qaeda's number two leader, al-Libi, is dead.
Abu Yahya al-Libi was believed to be in his 40s. Next to Ayman al-Zawahiri, he's Al-Qaeda's most prominent face, charismatic and even described as someone with the ability to make Al-Qaeda seem, quote, cool to a younger generation of jihadis. The US considers him one of Al-Qaeda's biggest threats to the West. The Pentagon's Captain John Kirby welcomed news of his demise.
But look, this is a very dangerous individual, and for him to no longer be walking the earth would be a good thing for everybody. I think the leadership development program of Al-Qaeda has some health risks and hazards that we think are good.
The drone campaign remains a major irritant in the relationship between Pakistan and the US. Islamabad summoned America's top diplomat to convey its serious concerns over the airstrikes. The pressure on Al-Qaeda in Pakistan may encourage the terrorist group to seek new havens elsewhere. A growing number of experts now pointing to an influx of militants into Mali. This is Jane Cowan in Washington for AM.
The Reserve Bank cut the official interest rate yesterday for the second month in a row, but still the big four banks are yet to say if they'll pass it on in full. The Chamber of Commerce and Industry says the cut of 25 basis points is for borrowers and not the banks. However, the RBA itself noted in its statement that while Australia is experiencing modest growth and low unemployment, households and businesses are still exhibiting a degree of cautious behaviour. To discuss the result, we're joined by the Finance Minister, Penny Wong. Speaking to her is our Chief Political Correspondent, Sabra Lame.
Minister, good morning and welcome to AM.
Thanks, Sabra. Good to be here again.
None of the big four banks have moved yet. The indications are they won't pass on the full amount. Is there any justification for them to pocket some of it for themselves, given the uncertain environment and their increased funding costs?
Well, look, can I say first, I think everybody would say to the banks, time to front up. No point in hiding and not telling people what your decision is. And the second point I'd make is this. I think their customers expect them to pass the rate on. The reality is governments don't regulate interest rates, as you know, and there's a reason for that. When governments did, then obviously the supply of credit was constrained. But what we can do is what we've done, which is to increase competition. And we would encourage people to shop around. Since our banking reforms have been put in place, we've seen actually more Australians swapping banks or looking at different institutions, and that's the best way to make sure you get the best deal.
They might have swapped banks, but that competitive banking package hasn't actually had much impact on the banks themselves being more competitive. And every time the Reserve cuts rates, you're just now reduced to jawboning them.
Oh, look, I don't accept your proposition, actually. I think there has been an effect, you've seen, for example, the bank's removal of exit fees. What I keep saying to people is just make sure you're getting the best deal that's available. There are a number of deals out there. There are a number of arrangements with different institutions. Obviously, you need to take get financial advice if you require it. But if you're not happy with what your bank is offering, you should go somewhere else. And I would hope that the big banks understand that they are in a market where people do have choices.
Well, the official cash rate now is near the emergency levels, nearly of the global financial crisis. They're at 3.5%. 3.5%, just a half a percentage point higher than what they were during the GFC. But variable home loan rates aren't anywhere near the lows of that time. They're nearly 2 percentage points higher now than then. Is that just price gouging?
Oh, well, you know, I'm not going to defend the banks, unlike some. I think it's up to them to explain to customers and to the markets why their funding costs increase. But look, the Reserve Bank has said, certainly in the previous decision to cut interest rates just prior to the budget, that they obviously look at what the market rates are being paid and they factor that in. But I would say, let's remember, this is good news for homeowners and borrowers. It is we see interest rates, as you said, the cash rate at 3.5%, lower than at any time under the previous coalition government, and a great cut before the budget, rate cut after the budget, demonstrate what the government was saying. We want to bring the budget back to surplus because it does give the Reserve Bank the flexibility to move should it want to do so, and it has.
The Reserve Bank statement noted that despite low unemployment and modest growth, consumers are still exhibiting a degree of precautionary behaviour. Are consumers just so scared because of the approaching carbon tax?
Oh, look, there are a number of things weighing on confidence. I think the primary thing is what people see on the TV and what they read in the papers about what's occurring in Europe, and that's obviously weighing on confidence. People have also made the choice, a pretty sensible choice, you would think, to not return to the levels of dis-saving, that is spending more than you save, or spending more than your income, that we saw a number of years ago. So households have made a decision to improve their savings. That's not necessarily a bad thing, but obviously it has an effect in terms of the economy, but we've got to remember also, despite the best attempts by the coalition to talk down the economy, which is not good for anybody except Tony Abbott, it's not good for working families, despite their best efforts, we have to remember we have some pretty solid economic data here in Australia, including a very big tick of confidence from the world in terms of the investment pipeline. I mean, $500 trillion being invested in this country, that shows what the world thinks of our economy and our prospects.
Well, the opposition says the only reason the Reserve Bank moved was because of the deteriorating world picture, not because of this government's economic management.
Well, Joe Hockey should be reminded of what he said to the international press a couple of days ago, where he acknowledged that a surplus does give central banks like the RBA the room to move. A rare moment of frankness in which he acknowledged it. The reality is we've had interest rate cuts prior to the budget, we've had an interest rate cut since the budget, it demonstrates what the government's saying, which is in an economy that's returning to trend growth, you should give monetary policy the room to move. The way you do that is to implement the fiscal strategy, that is the budget settings that the government has.
The Prime Minister is hosting an economic forum next week. Will anything concrete come from it, or will it just be a talk fest?
Look, I think it's really interesting. I think, I'm not sure if you asked me that, but others asked me that before the tax forum, and I thought we had a very good discussion last year at the tax forum, which included a working group out of it to look at business tax reform, and one of the recommendations was picked up in the budget. That's the flexibility in terms of loss carryback, where people, small business particularly, but businesses can offset profits against past losses. Gives people a bit of flexibility at this time of structural change. I'm in for more dialogue. We're undergoing a pretty massive change in our economy at the moment because of what's happening globally, the shift from economic power towards Asia. We should keep having business leaders and political leaders talking about and implementing the things which are needed to ensure prosperity for this generation and the next.
Minister, thank you very much for joining us this morning.
Good to speak with you again, Sabra.
The Finance Minister, Penny Wong, speaking there with our Chief Political Correspondent, Sabra Lane. And you're listening to AM around Australia, where it's approaching 19 and a half minutes past 7. You'd think that a boom in mining would also mean a boom for those who carry the ore to ports. However, QR National, one of the world's largest rail transporters of coal, which services 50 mines across the country, has announced plans to slash 500 jobs from its workforce. It follows 600 voluntary redundancies announced last year. Unions say the latest decision is devastating and will hurt local communities across Queensland. Dubrovka Volada reports.
In the space of 18 months, QR National has announced a 12% reduction in its workforce. Rail, train and bus union national organiser Bob Nanva.
Moves like this will have a devastating impact on workers individually and on the communities from which they come from. QR National is a hub in many regional communities, and to slash and burn workers in the manner that they're describing would have a lasting impact on many of those regional areas.
QR National was privatised in 2010 after almost 150 years in state government ownership. The company blames the job cuts on its inheritance of high staffing levels and bureaucracy. It declined to be interviewed by AM, but said in a statement that its cost base is too high compared to its industry peers and competitors. But Bob Nanva disagrees.
Look, when these private buyers of QR National were buying into the company, they would have done their due diligence, they would have known what the cost structures were, and they would have known what the business model was. So to disingenuously now claim on the back of dodgy figures that their labour costs are holding their business back is just plain nonsense.
The company's website declares it's one of the world's largest rail transporters of coal and picks it up from over 50 mines across Australia. Bob Nanva says coal production in Australia is expected to rise in the next few years. He says it's not the sign of a sector or company in crisis.
These are independent economic forecasts, not ours, that are telling us coal production will rise from 520 million tonnes by 2015 and 596 million tonnes in 2020, up from 370 million tonnes today. That is hardly the sign of a sector in crisis. And for a company like QR National, with profits of around $540 to $580 million to be crying poor, is disingenuous to say the least.
The company has started a consultation process with its workers and unions. The voluntary job cuts will start in August.
Dubrovka Voloda reporting. The Queen has delivered a message of thanks at the end of 4 days of celebrations for her Diamond Jubilee, describing the response from people as humbling. Massive crowds continue to gather as they've done throughout, something she said had touched her deeply. The Queen was without her familiar consort, husband Prince Philip, who turns 91 this weekend and who is in hospital recovering from a bladder infection. From London, correspondent Lisa Miller.
The Queen joined 2,000 others for a Thanksgiving service at St Paul's Cathedral. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Rowan Williams, paying tribute to her lifelong dedication.
What we remember is the simple statement of commitment made by a very young woman, away from home, suddenly and devastatingly bereaved. A statement that she would be there for those she governed, that she was dedicating herself to them.
And in return, they dedicated themselves to supplying a sea of Union Jacks and an almost continuous serenade. They lined the streets from St Paul's to Westminster and to Buckingham Palace. The final leg of the Queen's journey was in an open-air carriage, the threatening rain holding off for just long enough. Prince Philip was absent. He's still in hospital, recovering from an infection. As the family stood on the palace balcony, there was an Air Force flypast, the sight of Lancasters, Spitfires and the Red Arrows, bringing a broad smile to the Queen's face.
On the Mall here with all these people, you get the sense that this is not just about celebrating the monarch or the royal family, but also an opportunity for a country that's been through some hard times to just enjoy itself.
I just feel really proud to be British. It just gets everybody together. You know, there's lots of horrible things going on in the world. It brings everybody together for a really good celebration.
The state of the economy at the moment, you think might have something to do with it as well?
Well, but yeah, today's about celebration. It's not thinking about that. And that's what this is so lovely. It's good news for change. Good news.
I think it encompasses everything that Britain's about, really. To be honest, it's a celebration of everybody, not just the Queen and her 60 years. It's everyone getting together.
Your Majesty.
Barack Obama added to the international tributes.
And while many presidents and prime ministers have come and gone, Your Majesty's reign has endured. As I said last year at Buckingham Palace, that makes Your Majesty both a living witness to the power of our alliance and a chief source of its resilience.
And then finally, after days of what seemed like euphoric outpourings from her subjects, a message from the Queen herself.
The events that I have attended to mark my Diamond Jubilee have been a humbling experience. I hope that memories of all this year's happy events will brighten our lives for many years to come. I will continue to treasure and draw inspiration from the countless kindnesses shown to me in this country and throughout the Commonwealth. Thank you all.
This is Lisa Miller in London for AM.
People around the world have had their eyes turned to the sky to catch a glimpse of the transit of Venus this morning. This movement of Venus across the sun is an event that won't happen again for more than a century. In a partnership between NASA and Columbus State University, two American scientists have decided that a school lawn in Alice Springs is the best place to broadcast the event to millions. Reporter Caddy Brain has been speaking to scientist Michael Johnson about what they're hoping to see.
If you try to look with it with your eyes, which you don't want to do because you never want to stare into the sun, it's going to look like a tiny disc going across the sun. And so what makes it so special, this only happens every 105 years. And when some of the earlier expeditions, when they first did it, they got their calculations wrong. So they had to wait another 105 years.
For two American scientists, a school lawn in Central Australia might seem like an unusual place to observe the transit of Venus. But Michael Johnson from Columbus State University says Alice Springs is an ideal location.
Actually, there are two reasons why we picked Alice Springs. The first one is that we can see the entire transit from Alice Springs. The second is Alice Springs has great weather during this time of the year.
With just one desk, two laptops and two rather simple-looking telescopes, the scientists will combine their footage with some taken in the Gobi Desert in Mongolia and Utah and Georgia in the United States and broadcast the event live for online and television.
What we have are we have two solar telescopes. These telescopes are specially made to actually look at the sun so that we can see the sun safely. What's going to happen is we're going to put two high-definition cameras on there. Those will feed into the computers, and from the computers we'll actually be transmitting them all over the world through our website, through NASA TV, and just any other means that we can get them out.
But for scientist Lance Tankersley, the event's very much about education as well.
If you have a young child who has the gift of being a painter, if they never are handed paintbrushes or a canvas, they will never be an aspiring painter. So that's exactly what we're trying to do, is to make that connection of science and inspiration and inspire the next astronaut and scientist.
For Year 7 student Ha Tran, the event has shown him some of the wonder that other generations have felt about scientific discovery.
I am very excited because it's such a privilege for this people to come here, and like, it's quite special. Not everyone gets to do it. And I'm quite glad, actually.
That excitement is just what teacher Matt Scoss was hoping the visit would bring to his students. But he says the kids have kept the scientists on their toes as well.
I was really delighted to see the kids really listening intently, but also, when invited, just asking some quite interesting questions and just really getting into it. Alice Springs has probably the highest density of scientists per capita of any locality in Australia. But it's really good for the kids to see a completely different field of science and be exposed to real scientists. And I think for a public school, it's really important for people from the community to actually set foot in the place and be privy to some of the goings-on.
But against the instructions of his teacher, student Ha Tran decided not to invite his friends and family to the event today.
I want to be the only one in my family to see that, so I'll get to be the special one. Make them jealous.
Year 7 student Ha Tran from Alice Springs, ending Caddy Brain's report on the transit of Venus. To finance, and Wall Street has closed higher after growth in the US services industry tempered concerns that the world's biggest economy might be slowing. Earlier, European stocks gained a little. In New York, the Dow Jones closed up 26 points, the NASDAQ up 18 points. The dollar is buying 97.4 US cents, 76.7 Japanese yen, and 78.2 euro cents. I'm Tony Eastley. Thanks for your company, and that's AM for today.